The Modernist Fundamentalist Debates of American Church History was presented by Tim McIntosh on November 14, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Jack is not here this week, and Tim McIntosh has graciously agreed to teach today. I'll bet a lot of you know Tim, but we thought that it might be worthwhile to introduce him for those of you that don't know him. He is a newest tutor at Gutenberg College. We're really happy that he's come along. He's doing a great job. He and I have something in common. We both got our master's degree from Reformed Theological Seminary, so we can trade stories on that institution. Tim is a playwright. I don't know if you have had an opportunity to see any of the plays that he's written that the Gutenberg students have done, but in my humble opinion, they're really good. So the next one that comes along, I would really encourage you to come and see, because I think he does a great job there. He's also an actor, and he is a writer. He's teaching writing at Gutenberg. So I'll let him tell you what it is he's going to do, but welcome, Tim McIntosh.
Thank you, Ron. Thanks, everybody. This is my, I am the son of a pastor in Atlanta, Georgia, but this is my second time ever in a church pulpit actually speaking. The first time, there were six people there. It was in Bogart, Georgia. And I think by the end, I think there were three people left when I got done. This hopefully will go a little bit better. This is a talk on the modernist fundamentalist debates of American church history. And if that sounds like a real specific, peculiar topic, like why are we going to talk about something so nuanced and small, hopefully by the end you'll see it's not nuanced and small at all. It's not a really particularized, localized debate. But I would kind of argue that the vote last Tuesday that took place in the United States is kind of a downhill outcome or a downstream outcome from the modernist fundamentalist debates that started in the late 19th century. And maybe by the end of the talk, you'll understand why I think that. A couple of reasons why I'm giving this talk, of course, because Jack's out of town. He asked me if I'd be interested in doing something on church history because it's kind of an interest of mine, and I said yes, and I proposed a couple topics. And when I proposed the modernist fundamentalist debates, he said, ooh, yeah, that would be a good one. That, I think, might really interest RF. So hopefully you'll be interested in the subject. I'm personally fascinated with the subject. I have become, a little bit crazed by understanding why what has happened in the American church since our founding. I almost think of it as sort of like Bible study applied. When you actually look at what happens in the American church, you see how people who are Christians try to live out the Bible, or well, not so well, in their culture. So I kind of think of it as Bible study applied. End of the beginning, I'm going to use the term, and I've already used the term, modernist to describe a particular branch of theology that gets its start in the late 1800s. You'll probably be more familiar with, if I said the word liberal theology, everybody would be like, yeah, I kind of know a little bit about what liberal theology is about. But I'm going to use the word modernist because it has a more nuanced, specialized meaning. It's a little bit different from contemporary liberal theology. But they will become later on in the 20th century in the talk, they're close to the same thing. The story that I'm going to tell starts in 1874 with a pastor, a Presbyterian pastor named David Swing in Chicago. Anybody ever heard of David Swing? He was one of the most prominent preachers in the United States at the end of the 19th century. He published sermons. He preached to thousands every week. He was a confidant to Abraham and Mary Todd Lincoln. He was, in his youth, a fraternity brother to Benjamin Harris, who eventually became the 23rd president of the United States. But in 1874, he was accused of being a modernist. He was accused by a young man named Francis Patton, who was a Princeton professor. Swing and Patton were both Presbyterians, but they represented two camps within American theology that were growing apart rapidly. Let me describe the two camps. First, the modernists. The modernists, like David Swing, thought that old-time Presbyterian theology, or broadly American theology, traditional American theology, badly needed a facelift. After all, America at the end of the 19th century was a radically different place from the founding of the United States. The United States in 1874 was no longer the land of English Puritan farmers. The United States was an industrialized, multicultural by their standards, multicultural urban country that was facing radical, new, different problems. Most prominent of these problems were created by the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution, it's hard for us to imagine how much the Industrial Revolution changed the world, especially the United States, especially Britain and Europe. It changed nearly every aspect and every facet of human life. For the first time in human history, manufacturers had sources of power that did not depend on climate, season change, to generate electricity, or to generate power, excuse me. So small-town work was disappearing, and it was being replaced by urban work. Night and day, sowing and harvest no longer determined when a person got up and went to bed, what sort of work they did. But in its place, the precision and regimen of factory life was taking over. The Industrial Revolution was creating massive amounts of wealth, but massive amounts of wealth primarily for factory owners and less so for workers. Oftentimes, work days for factory workers stretched out for 12 or sometimes 15 hours a day, rarely for anything more than minimum wage. Poverty often forced pregnant women to work until a day or two before their delivery. After delivery, they were required to report shortly back to work after the baby was born. Some mills employed children as young as 4 and 5. If you've ever read any Charles Dickens novel, Charles Dickens is documenting the trials and travails of the Industrial Revolution, primarily in London. But what London experienced and what the United States experienced in major cities were probably very similar. Modernists, like David Swing, had two reactions to the Industrial Revolution. First, they wanted to reform its ills. And second, they saw great hope in it. So I'm going to talk about each of these kind of two reactions that the modernists had toward the Industrial Revolution. First, they wanted to reform the Industrial Revolution, and they found that old-time theology, old-time American theology, lacked the resources to deal with the Industrial Revolution. According to old-time American theology, God dealt chiefly with individuals as individuals, not through society or societal structures. But the Industrial Revolution, the modernists said, surely created problems that couldn't just be addressed by individual conversions. They had to be addressed on a societal level, on a structural level. So the modernists had this sort of feeling, are we really going to preach individual salvation to these men and women who are living in slums, working 12 and 14 hours a day, who have sewage seeping through their streets, who have disease ravishing the inner city? Are we really just going to preach individual salvation to them? It doesn't seem in keeping with something like the book of James. Do not say to a man, keep warm and well fed while doing nothing for his physical needs. So the modernists looked beyond the sin of individuals and saw sin inherent in societal structures. the modernists would become something like the public party within American Christianity. They wanted to address public ills, not just private sins. They wanted to address things like poverty. They wanted to address things like slums and just the urban situation. So the modernists wanted to reform the ills of the Industrial Revolution, but they also saw great hope in the Industrial Revolution and all of the accompanying scientific advancements that were made during this time. Yes, they said the Industrial Revolution had brought great calamity, but it had been coupled with tremendous benefits. The 14 years between 1859 and 1873 have been characterized as one of the most technologically innovative in human history. Nearly every aspect of life was shaped by new inventions. Medicine, railroads, food processing, chemistry, steel production. No longer were surgery patients being cut open to intolerable pain, but now anesthesia was being used. Vaccines were developed for diseases like cholera and rabies. Slavery had been abolished, painfully, very painfully, yes, but nonetheless abolished. And there are rumors arriving from Europe of electric blankets and electric hot plates for everyday use. Might we, said the modernists, be getting better? Might human history not just be the story of repeated human hubris and failure, but maybe, just maybe, it's one of progress, of upward momentum? Look what had been accomplished in the 19th century. Railroads were zigzagging across the country, goods and services arriving from exotic lands. Maybe life was getting better. Modernist theologian Edgar Brightman would later write that he believed in God, quote, because I believe that history represents a steady moral progress. So coupled with these two reactions to the Industrial Revolution, the desire to reform it, and the desire to believe in it as a harbinger of progress, the modernists emphasized three theological changes. I'm not going to say tweaks, because they weren't tweaks. They were pretty major. First, God was not transcendent, shut off in heaven, our judge and above us and different from us. No, he is with us. He is immanent. So those of you who have studied theology, God is transcendent and God is immanent. Those are two big words basically describe. If you think that God is primarily transcendent, you see him as something different from humanity, fundamentally apart from us. Yes, our creator. Yes, our judge. But fundamentally and uniquely different from us. If you see God as primarily immanent, you see him as more of a more life force, not necessarily with the personality of the God of the Bible, but more of a force that moves in and among and through people. In my understanding, the Bible emphasizes both of these things, and it has always been a delicate balance to strike whether or not God is transcendent or God is immanent. The Bible describes God, of course, as our judge, as the supreme being, as one, the sole ruler of heaven, who gets what he wants when he wants it without any hesitation. But he's also described as the God that feeds the bird of the fields, who dresses the lilies of the fields. Paul describes him in Acts 17 as being our not far from each one of us. But the modernists wanted to tip that balance away from transcendence toward immanence. Instead of God breaking through the clouds to create the world, modernists saw him as working imminently through the ages to slowly build the universe. Thus, the modernists would be very friendly to this new theory that was developing, coming from Europe, called Darwinism. Because that's exactly what Darwinism was. Incremental changes. God didn't suddenly create humanity, but he gradually moved humanity along through a long process of evolution. A second major plank in modernist theology was a skepticism about miracles. Then we'll get back to the David Swing trial in just a second. But one more thing, two more things actually. Skepticism about miracles. Since the modernists saw science as a harbinger of great help, progress. They sought to make all sort of inquiry into the Bible and into the natural world take place along scientific lines. Here's a quote from Friedrich Schleiermacher, who actually is a kind of like a proto-modernist, but that won't show up on the quiz. Schleiermacher, "Science and religion should agree on this point. Both should abandon the idea of the absolutely supernatural because no single instance of it can be known by us, and we are nowhere required to recognize it." Let's get rid of the miracles. We're not really required to believe in them, said Schleiermacher. So let's just do away with it. Both science and Christianity can both agree on this point. Yeah, Christianity's going to have to make a few tweaks, but we can both agree on it. Third thing, modernist theology emphasized religious experience over adherence to a Christian creed. Religious experience was primary and more important than, say, obedience to the scriptures, knowledge of the scriptures, adherence to a particular set of doctrines. In the modernist framework, creeds, churches, and the scripture were cultural manifestations of a community's intuition of the divine. I'm going to read that again. That's a mouthful. In the modernist framework, creeds, churches, and the scriptures were all cultural manifestations of a group of people's intuition about the divine. So the modernists would look at the Old Testament, and they would think of it as sort of like the Jewish people's autobiography, if that makes any sense. So they would read the Old Testament, and they would say the Israelites are describing this sort of sense of the divine that they had as a community. Okay, then God came to us in a cloud, and then he came to us in fire, and then we named David king because God wanted us to. So this is just their experience of the divine, and they're recording it as if it actually happened, but the modernists say, but it didn't really happen. That's just kind of what they think happened. Okay. Returning to the David Swing trial of 1874, admirers of David Swing thought that he was the only preacher who could reach the thoughtful non-Christian in America. He was eloquent, he was influential, he was well-versed in the latest scientific advancements, but he also smelled like a modernist. Francis Patton from Princeton drew up charges that Swing was a heretic, and a large trial commenced in the Presbyterian Church, and the stage was set for a momentous clash. Now, when I say the stage was set for a momentous clash, don't think that all of America is watching yet. Those in the know were paying attention, but this is not like a widespread social clash yet. This is more a clash among the people who know, who are kind of in the know. Swing was the champion of the West, Chicago being the West back then. The champion of the modernist movement, and Patton was the champion of the East, of the Princeton University conservatives. For Patton and the movement that would soon call itself the fundamentalists, the message of the Bible was timeless. Yes, American life had changed. Of course it had changed. It changed drastically. But the basic message of the scriptures was the same. God was our mighty judge. He knew all. He directed all. And we, his children, his subjects, were corrupted by sin and in need of redemption. The trial lasted 1 month. Depending upon which side you were on, you either thought that Swing's answers were a little bit too hazy and nebulous and frustratingly evasive, or you thought that Patton's doctrinal demands were really overly persnickety and demanding. One minister said that Patton's standards for precise doctrinal statements were so high that Jesus himself would have to be clear on a number of points to not be guilty of heresy. The presbytery warned Patton that if he could not prove the charges against Swing, he must himself be censured as a slanderer in proportion to the malignancy or rashness that shall appear in the prosecution. So the stakes are high. Patton has second thoughts. Maybe he's going to back down. No, I'm not going to back down. He presses on. And Patton loses, Swing wins by a vote of 48-13 for Swing against Patton. And modernists everywhere were greatly encouraged. One of their own had been brought up on heresy charges, and he had not only survived, but it seemed like he had actually thrived. He had carried the day. Meanwhile, in New Jersey, the Princeton School of Theology began to counterpunch against these modernists. After the Swing trial, Princeton theologians like Benjamin Warfield, Charles Hodge, and then J. Gresham Machen began to publish tracts called The Fundamentals. These tracts were written by intellectuals for intellectuals in defense of traditional biblical beliefs. They argued for the believability of miracles, for the inerrancy of the scriptures, against evolution, and they began a strong intellectual defense. Now, so the Princeton School begins this strong intellectual defense, but meanwhile, kind of like a broader swath of American culture is kind of catching on to what's going on. There's this big change that's taking place. The modernists are like changing a lot of things that we have traditionally believed. So there's the Princeton School on this side, the social school on the other side, and these two are going to gradually come together. I'm going to talk for a second about the social side of the growing fundamentalist movement. The social side saw an old way of life radically and quickly disappearing. Not only was the Industrial Revolution changing life, but there were new scientific theories and advancements that were taking place, like Darwin's Origin of Species, like Karl Marx's Das Kapital, that sounded vaguely ominous and threatening. There was also, in the mid to late part of the 19th century, a massive influx of Catholics from Ireland fleeing the potato famine, which doesn't sound like a tremendously big deal to us now, but it was a massive, massive change to Protestant America, overwhelmingly Protestant America, now facing 1.5 to 2 million Irish Catholic immigrants. They came to Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore, and they caused tremendous upheaval. Just as a side note, if any of you guys know the story of the founding of Central Park in New York, it's a story of kind of a big clash between the English aristocrat Protestants and the Irish Catholics over who was going to play Macbeth in the opening of this big opera house. And basically it created a riot. Out of the riot, people recognized what a huge problem they had on their hands. They had all of these Irish Catholic immigrants who were living in these slums. They wanted their guy to play Macbeth, but the English aristocrats kind of like pulled the rug out from under their feet, and they got their guy to play Macbeth. So a lot of wealthy entrepreneurs in New York City recognized that this is not an acceptable situation. So what are we going to do? Let's open up museums, let's create public libraries, and let's also create Central Park, which will be, they called it, a garden of democracy, where Irish Catholics and Protestants can get together and mingle and hopefully not stab each other. It's a fascinating story. At the same time, revivalism was becoming, which has always been somewhat popular in the United States, was becoming very, very popular. We have to stop and talk about Billy Sunday, who was one of the most popular revivalists of the late 19th century. Billy Sunday was a professional baseball player, but he retired to become a revivalist, and he would preach in huge tent revivals. To begin his sermons, he would set up a home plate in the middle of the pulpit and come rushing in from off stage and slide across the plate and then leap up and say, "The devil says I'm out, but the Lord says I'm safe." Then he would begin to preach. He is not what you would call theologically sophisticated. When pressed to explain his theological beliefs, he would often answer, "That's just too deep for me," or, "I'm going to have to pass that one up." He once said, "I don't know any more about theology than a jackrabbit does about ping pong, but I am on my way to glory." Sunday and the other revivalists also tended to be very, very patriotic. And they saw a link between America and the preservation of Christian civilization. a few quotes from Sunday. This may be a digression, but I got to do it. Sunday, Christianity and patriotism are synonymous terms for hell and traitors. Christianity and patriotism are synonymous terms, and hell and traitors are synonymous terms. During World War II, Sunday ended his sermon by waving a flag and saying, "If you turned hell upside down, you will find 'Made in Germany' stamped on the bottom." Praying before the House of Representatives in 1918, he advised God that the Germans were a great pack of wolfish hungs whose fangs drip with blood and gore. The Princeton School, for probably obvious reasons now, were very reluctant to join with this kind of populist Christian movement like Billy Sunday, because the Princeton School is this robust theological intellectual movement. They know what they're talking about. They know what the debates are. But gradually, they begin to sort of join together with this more cultural movement, begrudgingly, but it does happen. Most of the alliances between the Princeton School and the kind of broader cultural movement, let's just call it fundamentalism now, happened during summer camp meetings. So, when you think about the fundamentalist movement, late 19th, early 20th century, think about it as riding on two rails. One, Princeton theology, and two, revivalist populism. So, the fundamentalist movement is peculiar in this way. It's intellectual, meaning it has an emphasis on study, the printed word, the scriptures, theology, but it's also very populist, sawdust, big tent preaching. And in the words of historian George Marsden, fundamentalism was a movement simultaneously of the establishment, the populists, and the outsiders. They merged together into one. One more ingredient to fundamentalism, then I'll move on. There's a new theological method kind of gaining ground, which was very different from the Princeton School, and it was called dispensationalism. I don't know how many of you guys are familiar with it. It's a big word. Long, short explanation for dispensationalism is that they believe that God dealt with human beings in different ways in different eras. So before the time of Christ, God dealt with humanity primarily through the law. Before the law was given, God dealt with humanity primarily through the conscience. After the time of Christ, God dealt with humanity primarily through the preached gospel. So there are different eras or dispensations in dispensationalism. God acted in different ways toward humanity in these different dispensations. Dispensationalists tended to be very interested in end times prophecies, and their way of reading the Bible might be described as literal, but also kind of flatly literal. If the Bible says the earth was created in 6 days, a dispensationalist might say it was created in 6 days. If you objected that it's hard to have a day before the sun and moon are created on the fourth day, doesn't matter. Bible says day, it means day. So kind of flatly literal. So, the modernists had become the public party. They wanted to reform and redeem social structures. They wanted to deal with sin not primarily as an individual problem, but primarily as a cultural, societal problem. The fundamentalists, on the other hand, became the private party, less concerned about social structures, more focused on the individual. I'm going to pause here and say, historians often refer to fundamentalism as a great reversal. This is a big change, and here's the big change. During the First and Second Great Awakenings in the United States, these First and Great Second Awakenings were oftentimes big movements toward Christianity, often prompted by really eloquent and persuasive open-air preachers like George Whitefield or like Jonathan Edwards. Typically, in the first two awakenings in the United States, there's a very strong social component in conservative Christianity. So when George Whitefield came and preached, he also would take up massive collections for an orphanage that he would send back to Great Britain. During the Second Great Awakening, there's also a really strong emphasis on being socially active as a Christian, on doing your part to help your community. But during this time, conservative Christians began to back away from social involvement and favored instead individual salvation was the primary emphasis. Dwight Moody, who is considered in some ways kind of the father of the fundamentalist movement, and he was one of the most popular preachers of his day, said that when he preached in the city, he used to carry in one hand a Bible and in the other hand a loaf of bread, but he decided that he would only carry the Bible because the loaf of bread would only feed now, whereas the Word of God fed eternally. So that change is a significant change from the way that like the early Christians in America would have viewed it. They would have viewed both that evidence of an individual's piety is that it produces some sort of real effort on behalf of one's neighbors. Fundamentalism gathered momentum with the publishing of a 12-pamphlet series between 1910 and 1915. Two California oil mission millionaires, Milton and Lyman Stewart, subsidized the publication of these booklets, and over 3 million copies were distributed to teachers, preachers, youth leaders, and professors. The five basic tenets of fundamentalism were boiled, the major tenets of fundamentalism were boiled down into five major points. They are these. Number one, the inerrancy of Scripture. The Scripture is without fault in any of its details. Second, Christ was born of a virgin. Third, Christ is our substitutionary atonement. Fourth, Christ was physically resurrected from the grave, not just spiritually resurrected from the grave. And five, Christ performed miracles, real miracles. Does the list seem peculiar? I don't know if that seems peculiar to you. If I asked you to like write down what you believe is basic Christianity and you only had five sentences to do it, that might not be the five things that you chose. But for the fundamentalists, these were the five things because the modernists were specifically attacking these five points. They understood this to be, if we could defend these five points, the inerrancy of the Scripture, the virgin birth, substitutionary atonement, physical resurrection, and the miracle working power of Christ, if we can hold those five points, then kind of like Christianity will stand. But if we give way on those things, the modernists will encroach and take over. Fundamentalism and modernism could not peacefully coexist for a very long time. These were warring factions that were arguing over the spiritual and intellectual future of the United States, and a massive clash ensued in 1925. The Scopes Trial, or the Monkey Trial, in Dayton, Tennessee. Now, a little bit of self-disclosure. I went to Bryan College in Dayton, Tennessee. You're all like, really? What was that like? Bryan College was named after one of the participants in the Scopes trial, William Jennings Bryan. Maybe I'll talk a little bit more about Bryan College when we're done. Here's what happened. John Scopes, a high school biology teacher, was accused of violating the Butler Act. The Butler Act made it unlawful to teach evolution in public schools. But the ACLU got John Scopes to basically kind of, they said, we will cover the cost of your trial. If you teach evolution, we want to kind of start a court fight. So Scopes teaches evolution, and the court fight ensues. If any of you have ever heard of the play or the movie Inherit the Wind, this is kind of based on after the Scopes trial. It pitted two heavyweights against each other, William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow. William Jennings Bryan was a four-time Democratic presidential candidate who preached and wrote for the fundamentalist cause. His nickname was the Great Commoner. His primary argument for against the teaching of evolution in public school was that it was a threat to Christian civilization. So he wasn't going to argue against it on scientific grounds, but largely that it was a threat to Christian civilization. Quote, in countries where other religions and philosophies prevail, except where they have borrowed from Christianity, they have made no progress in 1,500 or 2,000 years. He believed that teaching evolution was against the will of the people And it would also have deleterious effects on the people when they, if they came to believe that they had been descended from apes. Clarence Darrow, a high-powered attorney and an agnostic, volunteered to defend John Scopes. And the highlight of the trial occurred when Darrow got Brian to actually take the stand. So here it is. Everybody's watching at this point. Brian goes on the stand, and he's going to be cross-examined by Darrow. Darrow was a first-rate wit, and he made Brian look somewhat foolish on the stand. I've got a short excerpt from the trial. Darrow: "Mr. Brian, when was the flood? About 4004 B.C.? Brian: That has been the estimate of a man that is accepted today. Darrow: But what do you think? What does the Bible say itself? Don't you know how it was arrived at? That date, 4004 B.C.? Brian: I never made a calculation. Darrow: A calculation from what? Brian: I could not say. Darrow: From the generations of man? Brian: I would not want to say that. Darrow: What do you think? Brian: I do not think about things that I do not think about. Darrow: Do you think about things you do think about? Technically, Brian won the case. Scopes was found guilty and ordered to pay the fine of $100. But in much popular opinion, Brian looked the fool and the fundamentalists looked the fool. After the Scopes trial of 1925, fundamentalism went underground. In essence, the walls went up and the fundamentalists bunkerized. And again, this is a peculiar thing about fundamentalism, because it's not a small movement. It is a big movement. But there's a lot of hostility to kind of the outward world. So a big movement that thinks of itself as being in the minority, even though maybe it's not in the minority. Okay. What has happened since the Scopes trial? I'm going to cover this very quickly, and then we will be all finished, and there'll be time for questions. Fundamentalist theology is no longer a robust, burgeoning theological movement. Fundamentalism became so inflexible and intolerant and narrow that they now seem to be a dying tribe. This is not to say there aren't fundamentalists out there still. There certainly are. But as a robust, broad theological movement, it's not flourishing. Within fundamentalism, a reform movement developed, and it's probably the reform movement that we're all pretty familiar with, which is the evangelical movement, is coming out of the fundamentalist movement. Evangelicalism demanded that American Christians leave the backwater debates of fundamentalism and re-engage in popular culture, in politics, in the arts, in the academy. The evangelicals were led by populists like Billy Graham, and intellectuals like Francis Schaeffer and Carl F. H. Henry. Gutenberg students read Francis Schaeffer, and I'm sure that some of you are probably fairly familiar with Francis Schaeffer. Gutenberg students have been frustrated, I think, in the years that I've been at Gutenberg, with Francis Schaeffer sometimes seems a little bit outdated, or some of his scholarship seems a little bit, I don't know the nice way to say it. His scholarship some seem to be too broad. I like to remind them that he was writing these books, that Francis Schaeffer was writing these books when fundamentalist colleges across the United States were debating whether or not to show Bambi. And so when Francis Schaeffer comes along and he's talking about the Italian existentialist filmmakers like Fellini, I mean, this is, no one has ever heard of someone like this before, okay? So I always try to kind of like defend Francis Schaeffer that, okay, he might be a little bit dated now. He may have painted with an overly broad brushstroke. But think about where he was coming from. This Francis Schaeffer felt like fresh air to a Christian who wanted to think in the 60s and 70s and 80s. So fundamentalism as a theological movement does not really, it exists only in small pockets now. Modernism as a theological movement is very, very different from its early 20th century form. Modernism fell on hard times, especially during World War I. The optimism of liberal theology, of modernist theology, seemed very naive in light of World War I. Walter Lippmann described it as seeming to be a daydream during a spell of exceptionally fine weather. Richard Niebuhr described modernist theology this way. The message of modernist theology is a God without wrath, brought men without sin, into a kingdom without judgment, through the ministrations of a Christ without a cross. There just wasn't much substance to modernist theology. Those within the church that adhered to modernist theology found more and more, we just don't have anything in common with churches. We're just not Christians. And I think they gradually just joined mainstream culture. They just recognize we shouldn't call ourselves Christians anymore. So the descendants of modernism largely exist outside of church walls and in broadly in American culture. So the modernist fundamentalist debates don't really exist anymore as a theological debate, but it's more a broader cultural debate now. The modernist modernism and fundamentalism are the taproots for the culture war that the United States has been engaged in throughout the 20th century. So the little fishes on the backs of cars, the gospel fishes, being eaten by the Darwin fishes, being eaten by the truth fishes, this is all downstream from the modernist fundamentalist debates. That is all I have. Questions and comments?
Yeah, with Christian Science, did that pop up during the modernist movement?
I think what I know about Christian Science is it's a misnomer. It sounds like it would have a lot in common with the modernist movement. I think it's just its own thing entirely. Mary Baker Eddy, she was very persuasive. Her books, a lot of people found them very persuasive, but I just think of Christian Science as just doing its own thing. Okay. Though the name sounds like it might have a lot to do with modernism because of the affinities with the modernists had with science. Right. It's a different thing.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much, Tim. Did you play basketball at Bryan College?
I got cut.
Oh, no!
It's still painful still. Can you
sorry.
Tell?
I'm sorry. This is fun. I could tell you about some of my painful athletic failures. You talked about the Princeton, what do you call them? Princeton School. Were there, would you say, fundamentalists prior to the, whenever that was, 1870s, 1880s? Certainly there were Christians in America who believed those fundamentals that you just mentioned.
Right.
Would those people have been thought of as fundamentalists in how you're using the term, or would they have been something else? Like the Princeton School, was that the advent of fundamentalism?
Let me back up and go like pre-Princeton School. I think that broadly before the Second Great Awakening, before the Civil War, I think most... This is a big generalization, so bear with me. Most Christians would have believed in something like, most practicing Christians who were earnest about their faith would have gone to churches that had something like traditional Reformed theology. So God is sovereign. We cannot earn our salvation. We are not Catholics in that way. We are sinful and we are redeemed through Christ. So I think it would be more traditional Reformed theology. And I think the fundamentalist movement is an attempt to defend that from the encroachments of modernism, the strong affinity for science, for evolution, for updating certain central parts of Christianity. So the fundamentalist movement is, as I see it, primarily an attempt to defend traditional Christianity against modernism. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah.
In doing so, they joined with other flavors of theology that were kind of starting to take root, like dispensational theology. And so the fundamentalist movement wasn't merely when the Princeton School joined with a more popular school. When they joined together, the amalgam of theology that came out of that wasn't just Reformed theology. It was an amalgam of Reformed theology plus dispensational theology.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. The aspect of fundamentalism that you talked about as opposed to modernist, you talked about emphasis on individual as opposed to societal.
Right.
Reform, forgiveness, dealing with sins, and so on. The fundamentalists, did they kind of pull back from societal involvement? Is that kind of what you're saying a bit compared to the modernists? Or
I think they pulled back, but they're also society is becoming a word, I think, that in a way that it would not have been a word. It's a real live reality and a concept in a way that it wouldn't have been in, say, 1800. Because if you're a farmer, society is the neighbor down the street and the neighbor across the river and the guy who, you know, owns the farm next to you. But now, with all of these people moving into the cities, society is becoming kind of an urban, it's an urban thing. And so it's not just my neighbor who lives next door, but it's also the factory owner that I'm going to work for, and that other factory owner that owns that other factory down the street. And so I think the fundamentalists are having a hard time just dealing with that as a reality, that what is society itself has changed radically. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Thanks. Where I was going, and then I'll turn the mic on to somebody else. In talking about efforts to reform problems with society, I may be wrong about this, but my impression was that a large motivating group in terms of abolishing slavery, the abolitionist movement, and so forth, were Christians.
Absolutely
right. Which would have been a few decades before that.
Absolutely right, yeah.
So I'm wondering if those were actual believers seeking to do that, then was there a pulling back from that kind of movement?
Yes, I think there was.
Okay, I gotcha. And the modernists kind of...
Took their place.
I see.
That's the great reversal.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
You started by saying the recent elections we can see in them, however you put it, an example of kind of the downstream effects. Could you describe that a little bit in terms of how you see that playing out? I mean, obviously it's not just the recent elections. I mean, there's this kind of stuff going on all the time in politics.
Right.
In society, you see it on the news. You see, you know, various things going on.
When I said last Tuesday's election, I mean broadly the sharp and growing differences between the two major parties in America, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Republican Party, Conservative Party tend to look primarily, tend to be less concerned with social structures and more concerned with individual responsibility, a la the fundamentalist movement. And again, I'm not trying to say in any way that they are synonymous, that Republicans and fundamentalists are in any way synonymous, not at all. But there is a strong sympathy there. The Liberal Party, the Democrats, tend to look more at social structures and social reform as the primary purpose of politics. So for a conservative, the government needs to get out and let individuals determine their own ends. For liberals, government needs to be more involved, and because nothing else is big enough to actually change societal structures than government. Nobody's kind of strong enough. So I see those things as just one example of how they're kind of downstream from this old modernist fundamentalist debate.
So even though the terminology doesn't sound like or look like anything like the old debates, and most people would maybe make no connection or never have a thought about it, they've kind of inherited a certain set of or they've kind of inherited, a kind of debate in terms or sides to a debate that they're choosing and kind of going forward from there, even if they don't really see that they're downstream of something that was a big deal, 100 years ago.
That's my read.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one of the things, too, that I see going on is, because you talked about the reform movement within fundamentalism being evangelicalism. And, my background, I think most of us here, have been affected a lot by the evangelical Christianity one way or the other. And I know that for me, growing up in a conservative Baptist church and as a boy getting maybe a fairly fundamentalist kind of perspective in a lot of ways, but then as that church changed and as I kind of moved on, getting more of an evangelical type experience, one of the things I've noticed in my life amongst a lot of the people that I still see very much involved in kind of that story is going from how you engage in society is that you're really going out trying to witness to people.
Yeah.
It's like you're going to go extend yourself into society with, your four spiritual laws or, your mission or your, activity in that regard, to now a real emphasis on a kind of social type engagement, where you're trying to get involved in working, like say at a local soup kitchen or work, those kinds of things, and you still tie it in with your faith. You're not trying to say we don't talk about Jesus. You're still making that a part of it, but there really is this kind of this feeling like you really need to be out there engaging and changing the world. And
right.
maybe in your picture that is still outside of the politics. It's still at an individual level, but it is kind of a as Christians, we need to be out there kind of changing the world. That seems to be something that's really becoming quite popular.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, Tim.
Sure.
Two things. One, just a comment, and you can comment on it as well. About a month or so ago, OPB had a special on God in America. I think it was a three-night special. Did you see that?
No.
Okay. It addressed a lot of some of the issues you talked about, so I found it interesting and
worth
educational.
Watching.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Second thing is, this is totally, does Ayn Rand fit into this picture at all? I know nothing about her other than a snippet of a radio program I caught this week, and it sounded like she was an atheist with no use for altruism whatsoever.
Right.
And I thought, well, that's a really interesting combination because it doesn't fit the modernist atheist we think of at all.
Some of you know Casey Pilcher. She's doing an economics book study in Portland at her church, and just 2 weeks ago I did the talk on Ayn Rand. So this is in my wheelhouse. Ayn Rand is peculiar because she is exactly as you said. She's an atheist against altruism, radically against altruism. Don't do me a favor by giving me a ride to the airport. I'll pay you for a ride to the airport. That's what all human transactions need to be about. But she has become popular among conservatives because she is so adamantly concerned with individual responsibility. A little bit about her background. She saw the Russian Revolution basically happen outside of her window in St. Petersburg. And her father, who owned a pharmacy, had the pharmacy taken away by the Bolsheviks. They moved toward the Black Sea. And when the Soviets come in power, they take over his pharmacy again. So she leaves for the United States when she's 18 years old, and she sees the kind of horror of communism in the Soviet Union, and she's doing everything that she can to really emphasize the kind of unique strengths of America, which she saw as primarily individual responsibility. And the more the government encroaches on that, the worse we're going to be. So she's a wild card. She's in some ways really sympathetic with more conservative theological understandings, even though she's pretty rabid atheist.
I'm just interested in, I don't know if you have anything to say about this. I'm not exactly sure what my question is, really, but it's interesting to me, if you look at where the Princeton guys were coming from, I mean, as you say, very thoughtful, intellectual kinds of people, in some ways, where the way the fundamentalist movement came to deal with culture seems almost oil and water with where, I mean, some of the intellectual founders of that. And when I look at someone like Francis Schaeffer, on the one hand, he's very much standing for a conservative view of the Bible, and those fundamentals would all be things that he would subscribe to. But as you say, I mean, culturally speaking, I mean, he's writing about how, you know, we need to be looking at, you know, he talks about standing before Picasso's works and weeping and, you know, this kind of stuff. This is not what fundamentalists are doing. So how did this, I mean, it's hard to imagine how this all came together. I mean, it seems like maybe they tried to come together and just couldn't, or I don't know.
I've read a lot of Francis Schaeffer's letters. I don't know if you've ever read them, but they are fascinating, and they're wonderful because he became a Christian, I think, when he was a teen, and then he's really involved in the kind of fundamentalist movement. And when he and his wife move to Switzerland, he begins to have second thoughts, not about the kind of central claims of the gospel or the Bible, but about basically just the tone of fundamentalism and how antagonistic they are, not just with each other, but toward the outside world. And he doesn't know quite what to do with this, because here is the gospel advocating God so loved the world that he sent his son. On the other hand, he sees these really barbarous things being said among people who adhere to that. And when you read his letters, you get the sense that he's not the only one who's wrestling with this. This is a problem probably, and a lot of people are wondering about this. And it just seems like he's the one who gives most eloquent defense of why the fundamentalist, the tone of fundamentalism has gone so wrong. And Carl F. H. Henry, there's a similar thing going on with Carl F. H. Henry. He's sympathetic with conservative theology. He's a conservative in his theology, but he's looking at the fundamentalists. He's like, there's something dreadfully wrong here. And I think both of those guys are just so eloquent in explaining not only what they believe, but in how they see evangelicalism as different from fundamentalism, that they became widely read. Thanks, everybody.